Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nick Catman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as manufacturing and engineering. In each of those areas, we offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com, check us out, and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Dan Donovan. So Dan, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, absolutely. So I think a good way for us to get started is if I know we're going to be talking about how regulatory and quality and rare disease is different from typical drugs in normal populations. So before we get into that topic, could you just introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Dan Donovan, and I am the CEO of Rare Life Solutions. I've been in and around the pharmaceutical industry for 30 years, both in industry. I spent 13 years at Pfizer, and then on the service side of industry, where I started a company called Envision Pharma. Sold that company and then started my current company, Rare Life Solutions. And we focus on helping companies developing drugs for rare diseases do it better.
Okay, excellent. That was a very efficient introduction. So we'll jump right into the topic. So broadly speaking, how is the rare disease space different than typical drugs?
Ooh, so, you know, maybe as part of my introduction, I should have added, I've worked on typical drugs. I've launched some of the largest drugs in the history of the industry and drugs like Lipitor and the Coxibs when I was at Pfizer. And suffice it to say, the rare space is really different. It's really different for a lot of reasons. I mean, this is a really broad question, but we can start with some of the facts, right? So the definition of rare disease in the U.S. is that disease has 200,000 or fewer patients. So it's a very small number of patients. There are at least 7,000 rare diseases. And the challenge there is that very few of them actually have a treatment. Somewhere between 5 and 10%, probably closer to 5% of these rare diseases have a treatment. 50% of rare diseases impact children, and 30% of those kids won't live to see their fifth birthday. So there is a real urgency in rare to develop treatments and to try to save lives.
Mm-hmm. So you explained the population difference and the demographic information. Mm-hmm. What else can you share about the differences as it pertains to bringing those types of drugs to market?
So we have a philosophy about developing and commercializing drugs for rare diseases. And its foundation is in what we call the PAC, patients, advocates, and caregivers. So we believe that patients, advocates, and caregivers are the shapers of the ecosystem in rare disease. They're tremendously influential. They operate in a whole host of roles, from trialist to trial design, to author, to advisor, FDA advisor, company advisor. They serve in so many different roles. And the truth about the patients, advocates, and caregivers is they can make or break a product for rare disease. They can make or break a clinical trial. They can make or break a whole company. And they have done that. Most of it's very positive. They're incredibly passionate. And you get it, because oftentimes these people have kids with rare diseases and parents will do anything for those kids. And some parents go to the extent of starting up new biopharma companies to try to find a cure.
I've seen that.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. And there's a tremendous passion in the rare disease space.
Mm-hmm. Some of the lingo that I've heard associated with rare disease is rare disease designation, fast track designation, and orphan drug designation. So can you explain what each of those mean?
Yeah, so recognizing it's great that the FDA recognized a need to encourage academia and pharmaceutical companies to explore these rare diseases, to research them and to develop drugs for them. So they put a number of initiatives in place to encourage companies to do that. So orphan designation is simply a designation that a product is going to be developed for the treatment of a rare disease. That's the simple part. Rare disease designation provides a whole process and a whole bunch of benefits that the company can get when developing a drug for rare disease, from 7-year market exclusivity to 25% tax breaks on R&D that goes into development of the drugs, to a waiver of the prescription drug user fees, which can run in the tens of millions of dollars. I mean, they can be really expensive. And all of that is to motivate researchers to develop drugs for rare disease. Great stuff. And then the fast track designation is also fantastic because it allows companies developing drugs for rare diseases to get more time in front of the FDA. So whereas when you're developing a normal drug, you have certain milestones when you meet with the FDA. In the case of fast track designation, you can set meetings up with the FDA to discuss endpoints through clinical trials. Does it make sense to them? Things like that. Challenges that you may be having. So it's very helpful to do that over the course of development for these rare disease drugs, so you don't wait till the end and realize that you've got a hurdle that you couldn't clear. Mm-hmm. So fast track designation provides that opportunity.
It sounds like you have a pretty positive perception of those different programs. Is there anything else that you want to highlight in terms of the benefits of those programs? And also, are there, in your opinion, any areas of improvement that you would like to see happen in the future?
Oh boy, that's a loaded question based on my experience. It's not just those things that they've done. And I credit the FDA and the EMA for that matter, for making changes like this. The FDA has recently sought patient experience data to better understand that patient experience, the journey that these patients and their families go through over the course of their lives with these rare diseases, because it does influence drug development. It can influence how we design clinical endpoints. So they have meetings where they sit and they learn from the patients and caregivers themselves about, you know, what these life challenges are. So that's another good thing that they're doing. But it's not all coming up roses. I've had both personal experience on the pharma side and also experience on the service side, working with companies developing drugs for these rare diseases that have come up in front of the FDA, and it's gone really wrong. So there are certain things that we look for. We look for consistency in decision-making from the FDA, and many times that's not there. It depends on who's reviewing your submission package, what group you get in when you submit your submission package. Is it oncology? Is it GI? Is it the rare disease group? Because that's kind of left up to chance, and different interpretations by different people can have different results. Mm-hmm. And that's really what happened with a company that I was very much involved in. When we went up in front of the FDA with our regulatory trial completed, it was the largest phase 3 regulatory trial in that disease state, in the history of that disease state. It did miss its primary endpoint. So it didn't hit that 0.05%. But the secondary endpoints and these post hoc analyses were unbelievable. And the phase 2 data was mind-bending. It was so good. But because we missed the primary endpoint, the FDA rejected the drug. I mean, I'm putting it, this is in a nutshell here. It's a complex decision that the FDA has to make and the presentation that a company has to give. But that's kind of what it came down to. And it was really disappointing for a number of reasons. First and foremost is because this particular rare disease does not have an approved treatment. So these people, starting at a very young age, have to go through invasive surgeries to remove the colon, to remove the rectum, and it's a lifetime of monitoring, and it's a lifetime of more invasive surgeries and more risky surgeries and more side effects. And you know, it's a very challenging rare disease, and I feel for these people and their families. This drug had, in a subset of the population. And when I say subset, I'm talking a huge subset, 90% of the population showed 4 years disease-free, 4 years lack of disease progression. It was supposed to be a 2-year trial. We didn't hit the clinical endpoints that were required as part of the trial design. We extended the trial another 2 years, And we had a subgroup of patients who didn't have a clinical event for 4 years. And this to me was astounding. It was fantastic data. The opinion leaders were excited. There was hope in the community. But because we missed that primary endpoint, the FDA said no. And that has knock-on effects, right? So now this is a small company developing a drug for one rare disease indication, and the funding dried up. That was it, right? So they had to cut back and go through all kinds of things. Fortunately, it was acquired by another company who believes in the product. But it was a real challenging process to go through, and disappointing as well.
So that other company that you said it purchased it, are they working on it now, or is it shelved?
No, they are working on it, but with a lot of these companies in the rare disease space, now there are about 1,200 companies that are developing drugs for rare diseases around the world, for lots of different rare diseases around the world. Most of them are small, and most of them have resource challenges. And when I say resource, I'm almost 100% talking about dollars. The money that it takes to develop drugs is, as you know, it's huge. And so these small companies have to raise money, and they have to go through the process. They have to go public, and they have to go through the vagaries of the public markets and, you know, raise and get through the VCs and the private equities. And, you know, the job of the CEO is raising money. That's really what it comes down to for these companies. So when you have a result like we had, it has very, very damaging impact. People lose jobs. Hope is lost in the community. It's so many things that happen. But fortunately, in this case, another company acquired the product, but they also have limited resources. They're raising money. They believe in the product. Now it's going to take years to get to the market when I believe it should have been already available to the patients.
When you talk about the lack of resources, there's some other things that go along with that. You explain that companies sometimes are formed because a parent will have a child with a rare disease and will form a company, which I mentioned I've seen. You mentioned the cost of these trials. You talked about the size of these companies, which is small, and the challenges in terms of getting the appropriate funding so that you can get all of this work completed. I'm assuming some of the people that will be listening to this are in that spot. So I have a twofold question. One is, what advice would you give them? And secondly, if you had a magic wand within the realm of reality, what types of changes would you like to see that would helpfully facilitate more adequate funding for this type of research?
So two sides to that question. Let me start with the first part. What advice would I give? I would say be persistent, keep knocking on doors. And, you know, the old motto that you got to kiss a lot of frogs before you get a prince couldn't be more true when raising funds for companies that have drugs in development for rare diseases. You've got to talk to a lot of people. You've got to go to a lot of meetings. You've got to work your network and other people's networks. You've got to do everything you can do. If you really believe in that drug, if you really believe that drug or that device, whatever it happens to be, has promise for these people with rare diseases, then those are the things you have to do. And it can be grueling. You have to have a very thick skin, because you're going to get a lot of no's. People aren't going to believe in you. They're not going to believe in your drug or in your science or in your chemistry, whatever it happens to be, but you got to keep going. Mm-hmm. So that would be my advice. Don't give up.
Okay. And then the second part, the magic wand.
So I'm actually working on a little bit, a project right now. I'm on the coordinating committee of a project called Five Voices. And I think it is a bit of that magic wand, because my phone is ringing here. I'm going to try to get rid of it.
We can't hear anything.
Oh, good. Because what Five Voices did, and Five Voices was started by an amazing woman out of Germany, and she is an MD, she's a PhD, she is a very bright woman, and she recognized the need in rare disease to bring together five voices. And the five voices are regulatory, patients, investors, pharma, or business and payers, right? Those are the five key voices or five key players that are always in that space. Because when you're a farmer, you're developing a drug and you also need to have investors and you need to work with the patients, but you also are going to need to talk to the payers once your drug is approved and you're seeking reimbursement. So what we're seeking to do in this project, and we have over 200 people involved now. We've got pharma, big pharma, small pharma. We've got advocacy groups. We've got all kinds of, we've got investors. We've got payers involved. What we're seeking to do is provide consistency along that development and regulatory and then commercialization process in decision-making. So it is a huge undertaking. We've got a lot of data. We are starting to publish where we're going to be going with this Five Voices project soon. First paper maybe will be out in about 6 weeks to describe the whole project. But for me, that's it. To get some consistency and to help companies, particularly small companies who haven't been down this path before and don't have the process like the big Pfizers or the Novartises who have their way of doing things, but to help them get navigate a path through all of those channels to get to the end sooner. And the end is getting a drug to market for these patients.
I know this space is extremely passionate. I would say that there's a heightened sense of altruism in this space. So if people are hearing about this Five Voices program or entity and people want to help or get involved, are there opportunities where they can do that? And if so, how?
There definitely are. You can go and Google Five Voices and get in touch with Marina. Her contact details are right there. Or you can reach out to me and I'm happy to get people involved and to get companies involved.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I'm a big fan of stories. You mentioned earlier in the podcast that patients, advocates, and caregivers can make or break a successful application and study. What's your experience with other issues where people try to bring a rare disease drug to market and failed? You did bring up one. I'm wondering if there's anything else that you've experienced that you think is worth highlighting. And are there consistencies that you can highlight where failure tends to be caused by some issue? You mentioned one, which is research and resources, specifically financing. Anything else?
Can I start with a positive one? Because they're really positive ones too. And this is my favorite story. And I think a lot of people know this story already, but I always think it's worth repeating. And it's the Sarepta story. So Sarepta got the first drug approved for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It was an 11 patient trial that they went to the FDA with, 11 patients. Three boys did well on the drug. But what they had was the backing of the parents of these kids with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And they were very passionate. And they went to the FDA and they told their stories. And it was a really controversial decision. And people quit after the decision was made, but they approved the drug. They approved the drug on an 11 patient phase 3 trial where three of the boys did well. And we get to look at it in hindsight now and say, was this the right decision or was it the wrong decision? And for me, hands down, it was the right decision. And here's why. So the drug was approved and some of these boys got to be on the drug and they did well. But Sarepta filled their corporate responsibilities because they took the money they made from this one drug in Duchenne muscular dystrophy and have built a super impressive pipeline of drugs in Duchenne and other rare diseases. In fact, they just had a drug, Sarepta yesterday? Another drug was approved yesterday for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a gene therapy drug. But without the passion of the patients and the CEO at the time of Sarepta, Chris Garabedian, and the FDA to take a risk at that time, Sarepta wouldn't be the company it is, wouldn't have the pipeline, wouldn't be developing these drugs for multiple rare diseases. So that for me is a really positive story where Sarepta was persistent, the community was passionate, and the FDA made the right decision. So for me, a really positive story in rare disease.
Now the other side.
So, you know, I have a lot of stories about the other side, and I'll share one. So there was a company, and it's a super company. I really like the company. I'm not going to share their name right now. And they had a drug they were developing for an ultra rare disease. There was a mom who had a child with that disease. And I guess for some reason, she didn't really like the way the company was communicating with her, or maybe not communicating with her, or not fast enough, or the tone of it was wrong, whatever it happened to be. But she was a super influential mom in that space. And they had a trial that they needed to get patients for. She reached out to her community and said, do not enroll in this trial because this company is not a good company. And they couldn't enroll patients in the trial because of the influence this mom had. So whether she was right or wrong, or they were right or wrong, the fact is that she was passionate and she had an opinion, and we have to make sure that we all work together. We need to listen to the community. And don't just do one focus panel and check off a box and say, okay, we've listened to the community. You've got to engage them. You've got to engage them in a positive way and engage the community over the long term, from development when you're defining endpoints from a clinical trial to commercialization when you're pricing a drug, because these drugs tend to have really high prices and the community needs to know and understand why. So that was a negative for the company for sure. But lessons learned from that are many.
Good communication is the one that I got out of it.
Yeah. Good and consistent communication.
Yeah. And I'm not a glasses half empty type of person. I'm very much a glasses half full type of person. But I would speculate that people that are trying to bring these products to market are, because they're altruistic and positive and go-getters, I think they oftentimes are overly optimistic. And, I live in a constant state of being comfortably uncomfortable, meaning I'm comfortable because I have control over things, but I'm always uncomfortable because there are pitfalls that I'm not aware of today that I want to find out. And there's challenges that I'm going to face. But I haven't had that experience yet, and nor have I heard about those solutions. So the reason I wanted to focus on some of these challenges is to really help the rare disease market. So, you know, what are some of the other areas of challenges that you think companies that are entering into this space really need to know, whether it's, you know, clinical trial design or other aspects of trying to bring a product like this to market?
I think this is what we have to understand. We have to understand that rare is different. And a lot of people will say that, and they'll everyone go, oh yeah, nod their head and say, yeah, rare is different. Okay, we all get it. Rare is different. But then how are you going to change your behaviors because rare is different? How are you going to change your approach to development and commercialization because rare is different? So we have a concept that we talk to our clients about called hyper-targeting. You know, what's hyper-targeting? Why do we focus on hyper-targeting? Well, hyper-targeting is because in rare disease, you've got few patients. You have few experts, and the experts are spread out. You have few expert centers, which makes doing typical clinical trial work somewhat challenging. So the concept of things like decentralized clinical trials make a lot of sense in rare disease. You have rare diseases that never been studied before. So what are the appropriate endpoints? Is a 60-meter walking test an appropriate endpoint, which we do in a lot of rare diseases like Duchenne? Or, and I'm drawing from a father who I heard present about 2 months ago when he said, 60 meters is not what matters to me. What matters to me is, can my daughter get off of her favorite big couch and make it to the bathroom to brush her teeth? For him, that's a clinically meaningful endpoint. right? There's this kind of a subtle difference, but it's very real for patients in the rare space. So thinking differently along the way. And now I'll take it a little bit further. So what's hyper-targeting? Hyper-targeting is not going to huge conferences and setting up huge booths when there is a more focused conference where those people are going to be that you need to know and you need to be with. So we had an experience where someone wanted to present results at the DDW. It's a huge and great conference in the GI space. But there was another small targeted conference up in Seattle. And we said, that's where you need to be, because that's where your 200 physicians that treat this disease, that's where they're going to be. DDW, you get lots of people. But this is a hyper-targeting based on where those physicians that need to know about this disease that can help you develop the product are going to be. That's where we need to go. Excellent. Don't do radio advertising for your products. Focus in on those communities. Where are the communities? What are they doing? The advocacy groups that may be in that space. So this is what we need to do.
Excellent. And then for people that are interested in this hyper-targeting approach, how do they go about doing that? What added advice? And Dan, I'll just quickly mention, it looks like your camera paused. I don't know if that's something you can reset or not.
I see. I have the spinning circle right here, the spinning color palette right now. I don't know why. I can try to switch cameras if you want. Oh, no, I got the spinning. It won't let me switch cameras.
Okay. Well, we'll
I look surprised, though. I look very surprised.
It'll probably come back, but I think the content of the conversation is really the priority. So for people that are interested in hyper-targeting, you mentioned one conference in GI. That also is probably something that the market or the people in the rare disease space are interested in learning more about. So where can they find that information?
Where can they find the information about hyper-targeting?
And yeah, for their philosophy, for their specific spaces. Yeah.
We had a great discussion with hopefully, future client on Tuesday. And you've got to find people. So you can call me up, you can call Rare Life Solutions, you can email us, and we'd be happy to dive into hyper-targeting and help companies think more strategically about their approach in rare disease, both in development and commercialization, because it runs the gamut really from phase two right up through commercialization, when you really need to start doing that hyper-targeting.
Fantastic. And I think you're a great organization for people to reach out to that are interested in getting in this space. And, politely speaking, I think the FDA group is another good entity that can help these companies with any sort of regulatory quality compliance and FDA questions. So before we end today's call, is there anything else that you want to leave the audience with?
You know, I base my approach in rare disease the same way I based my approach to the last company I started, and it's about passion. And it's easy to have passion in rare disease and to see passion in rare disease, but it's also hard because you're dealing with some really challenging disease states, and you're dealing with children that may not live to see their fifth birthday. And families who see that they've got a hereditary disease, and they may or may not want to get genetic testing, because I don't want to know. I've seen what my dad's gone through. I'm going to roll the dice and I'm going to live my life right now. And if it happens, it happens. I just don't want to know right now. So there's so many complexities in the space, but for me, it's sort of bottling up that passion and using it really positively for the benefit of others. That's what it's about in rare.
Yep. Awesome. Well, Dan, I really appreciate you taking the time. I think that was really good information for the audience listening, and hopefully, everybody got a nugget out of it. So with that said, as always, if the audience finds conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at thefdagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to get in touch about project or resource needs, head over to thefdagroup.com and get in touch, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next time.